Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is Friday, May 8th. Wow, already 8 days into May. And we're on day 8,330 of 2020. But it is true crime time. And I am joined by Jen. Jen, how are you?
Fantastic. How are you?
I've had a day.
You have had a day.
I was telling Jen I've had a day. Postmates, yeah, 2 hours I was waiting, and then I'm just going to cancel that order because I can't get my Postmates card to work.
You know, Postmates is like falling down on the job because I Postmated, I ordered Chipotle, and since you're not there to watch them fill up the food, they start skimping, so I'm not real happy with Postmates either.
Well, that's true. You know, I didn't even think about that because at Chipotle, if they put – I always say, okay, you know, they put some beans. Could you put some more on there? And then, you know, more whatever. But the Postmates person's probably like, yeah, this is what they want. Just put it on there. I gotta go. I order my groceries through Postmates. I know you use Instacart. But here in California, we got to wait longer. Or at least in my area, Instacart can sometimes take a day and a half to get an appointment. So when you use Postmates to do it, although I get it more quickly, I have to type everything in by brand and such. And because they have very few preset options and it takes a long time. And I have had this issue before with Postmates where, you know, I guess they have some kind of credit card and they use it and there's never enough funds on it. So then they have to call somebody and then more funds are put on and there's always this delay. But I think this person who did it, they didn't know that there was a number to call or anything like that. And they just said, so, you know, I've seen it through. I'm sorry about their ineptitude and I'm done. And, you know, they give them this temporary kind of number to text you from. So if you try and reply to them after they hit the cancel button, they never see the message. And I just was going to tell them, you know, I think there is a phone number you can call. And, but they were gone. And then, you know, Postmate says, oh, your person canceled. We know you've been waiting 2.5 hours for this, but here's a $2 credit for your next order.
$2. Woo.
for your time. I do wonder, though, in that situation, if the Postmates people get paid. I don't know exactly how.
I hope they do, because, I mean, I do feel bad for them, and I do appreciate the fact that they are going out into the wild, so to speak, and, you know, doing this stuff for us. But in the same respect, I think Postmates should step up and maybe take care of their delivery drivers, you know, have a better customer service.
Yeah, I mean, they were at the grocery store for a long time, so I want them to get paid something. I just wish that I would have got my groceries. Okay, so we are in part three, the final part of the whole Cotton Club murder things. And, you know, I every week, so what I've been doing is I've just kind of been doing a little bit more and just going with the story and seeing where the story goes. And it's pretty darn interesting. And at this point, I'm not sure exactly how Robert Evans escaped prosecution at all. But considering how often he lied to law enforcement and all of this, when we last left off, we were talking about Roy Radin and how he and Laney had started to argue, and he wanted to cut Laney out of the movie deal with Robert Evans because Roy wanted to be a big shot. And then we had Laney's friend Anna Montenegro, who had started hooking up with Roy Radin. And then we also had this Tally Rogers guy who had stolen several $100,000 and some kilos of coke from Laney, and she supposedly had a hit out on her, so she's hired a bunch of bodyguards to protect her. Would you say that's kind of where we left off?
Yeah, that's the gist.
Yeah. So apparently, there was a new participant in this who's not really a big deal, but there's a guy named Jose Alegria who also gets 10%, but he has some money. And, you know, he's kind of involved. He's kind of trying to be a little negotiator and trying to help out Roy and Laney. So anyway, there was a quote from Anna says, I don't know what Roy saw in her that he didn't like, but he was very nasty to Laney. He got very greedy and wanted to con her out of the deal. So she thought he stole the cocaine and that's how the whole thing came about. I never get the sense that Roy stole the cocaine. I don't know how he would have stolen it. He didn't know the combination to this safe or whatever where it supposedly was.
Yeah, I don't think he stole the coke either. I was never convinced of that. But I do wonder if she convinced the two contract killers that that was the reason that they were going to kill Rory Raiden instead of the real reason, which was the fact that she was being cut out of this whole movie finance deal. You know, I tend to think that the contract people were like, yeah, you know, it's a drug deal gone bad, so we're going to whack this guy. But in the end,
I think so too.
Buy that theory.
And so while this is going on, even though Lainey is supposedly, you know, has a hit out on her, she flies to New York to go spend some time with Robert Evans. He's worked out a, he's rented out a townhouse and everything like that. And, you know, so she's doing business with him, and everybody was like, why are you doing business with her? I mean, Khashoggi was bad enough, and everybody's, you just don't do business with all these drug dealers. But I think Evans, you know, he said, oh, I didn't know she was a drug dealer. Everybody knows. He knew that she was a drug dealer. He's buying drugs from her.
Everybody knew. And if he was talking to Khashoggi for at least 2 minutes, then Khashoggi would have told him that Lainey was a drug dealer, because Khashoggi, in like intelligent papers that are available online, there's a whole 1981 report that wraps half of these people up in a whole sting that comes out of St. Petersburg, Florida, and flies right into Colombia. Half the players in this whole entire cold-blooded finance are linked to that operation. So they all knew what the other one was doing.
So Lainey goes to New York, and she tells Robert Evans about the stolen coke, and that she was under a lot of pressure, and that she hoped to repay Bella Chastis or whatever out of the money she'd make on the movie, and said that he didn't really care about the business. He just wanted to have some sex and stuff. And then, then there was, I guess Roy went to New York or something like that, and that Roy and Lainey had a huge fight, and Roy was saying that, you know, no woman's going to tell me what to do, and that Robert Evans intervened on Lainey's behalf, and that, and he didn't think that it was fair that Roy was trying to cut her out of the deal and all of that kind of stuff.
I think that meeting kind of, it was the glue that made all of this, the whole transaction happen, especially the death, because that fight was April of 1983. Roy Raiden dies May 13th. So I think Lainey made up her mind while she was in that townhouse, because she flew out the door crying. And that's the last time those two had actually seen each other face to face.
Here's something that happened that I didn't really understand. So a couple of days after that meeting, Robert Evans and Lainey go down to Miami. And Lainey's saying, yeah, you know, back and forth calls to Roy and all this kind of stuff. And that Roy even got offered $3 million to be bought out, which, you know, he'd probably still be alive if he had taken that. And that Allegria guy offered the $3 million. But Raiden wanted to be this, you know, Hollywood producer. And I think that that's kind of the thing. But what's strange about this trip is that Lainey drove Robert Evans over to Bella Chastis' mansion. This is the guy that supposedly has a hit out on Lainey if she doesn't pay him back. But here she is driving Robert Evans over to this guy's house. And
why would she do that? That's crazy.
And the prosecutors didn't understand it either, because she's supposedly fearing for her life. And so after that's over, they split there, and Robert Evans goes to New York, Lainey goes back to Los Angeles. And this is where, you know, and I what I think is Lainey talked to Bella Chastis about this and what they were going to do. And you know, maybe she asked permission. I don't know. Judging by the way he was acting after, who knows? The problem with a lot of this is that as this is all going down, there's a lot of other arrests that are going down in the whole drug industry. And I'm not even sure that anybody knew who was legit anymore and who was undercover. And because arrests started happening everywhere.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that the group became infiltrated, and everyone that was wrapped up in the Colombian drug war, they were starting to be compromised. So how did Lainey know who she could trust?
And so on May 12th, I think Anna knew more than she let on, and she said that she had started crying and that couldn't stop because Roy had made a dinner date with Lainey for later that evening so they could finally sort things out. And Anna said, quote, I get the feeling that something's wrong, and I start crying. And then Roy agreed to postpone the dinner to the following night because he didn't want to leave Anna alone. And Anna, obviously, being Lainey's friend, knew a whole lot about the coke business. I mean, she's the one who introduced Lainey to, I think, to Bella Chastis and stuff like that. And she also knew that if this Rogers guy, the guy who stole everything, kept evading, that there needed to be a fall guy. Somebody needed to die, you know, for the robbery. And maybe Lainey, back when she was talking to Belchess, has convinced him that perhaps Roy had something to do with it, because remember, he used to, you know, share a hotel room with Rogers, and they had, you know, escorts together, and they did drugs together. Maybe Lainey convinced him.
Yeah, what better way to get rid of Roy Radin than to wrap him up in a drug deal, you know, theft gone bad, and have the top drug dealer looking for him? You know, she knew that either she would have everyone's permission to get him whacked, or he'd eventually get whacked. So here he goes being the fall guy. She calls him up on the phone. Hey, let's go to dinner. At what part of Roy Radin thought, hey, that's a good idea. Yeah, let's bury the hatchet. I mean, she obviously had a history.
She did. And the thing is that Anna said that Roy had gotten a threatening phone call a few days before, and that he was scared even just to go into an underground parking lot by himself.
Because one of her husbands went to federal prison and said it was the best place for him to be because it was away from Lainey. I mean, I know. That's how dangerous she is.
So who does Radin get to protect himself on this date? Lainey's got, you know, a bunch of bodyguards with guns, including a sadistic killer. And Roy Radin, I kid you not, people who are listening right now, he gets his best friend, Damond Wilson. And Damond Wilson is on TV at that time on Sanford and Son. He is the son on Sanford and Son. This is who he gets to protect him. The guy is going to be trailing Lainey's car the whole time, and apparently is going to, if something happens, he's going to be there for him. It's an
or
odd
so he
selection.
Thought.
It's an odd selection for
it is
your,
an odd
you know,
selection, and the guy was a complete failure. So,
okay, so then you had May 13th. Lainey meets with a realtor because she's going to sell her house because she knows what's going to happen. So let's list the house so I can get out of here.
Hello, premeditation.
And she sent her son all the way across the country back to Miami with the nanny. So she has essentially given herself plenty of room to run, should she need to. So the night of the murder, Lainey, you know, shows up at Roy Radin's hotel and goes up there. And apparently they did some coke together. And before leaving, Lainey asked this guy to drive her to her apartment to get some coke she had left in her car and bring it back to the hotel. So they have some coke when they returned from dinner. And here's the thing. So this person was Radin's secretary, and Radin, you know, she obviously wanted to get rid of this guy to go get the coke so that way Radin would be alone. But Radin refused to really do that. So anyway, everybody gets into the limo, and again, you have Damond Wilson following behind, but somewhere on Sunset Boulevard, he lost track of it, and Roy Radin never actually made it to that dinner.
No, and this was all happening on Friday, May 13th, so a freaky Friday.
Yes, and that's why one of the people, the one who shot him, they put 13 bullets into him because it was Friday the 13th.
Yeah, well, you had the guy who picked him up in the limo was named Lowe. And he was in with the two contract killers that were in the car, which was Mincer and Marty. And one of the guys had said in the court papers that Marty just went crazy and started screaming 13 and shooting Radin. And then Mincer followed. So apparently that number meant a lot to them. But what gets me is not the fact that they riddled his whole body with bullets, but what did they do to mask his ID?
They planted a bomb in his mouth.
Yes.
Come on.
A stick of dynamite in this man's mouth, and they blow it up.
It took a month for them to find the guy. And it took 5 years for really anything to happen in the case.
Yeah, he went missing May 13th. He was discovered July 10th in the Garoman Desert in a dry riverbed.
Yeah, and so nothing really happened. I mean, it was 5 years. It was essentially until 1988 that something happened. In the meantime, and we'll get back to talking about everything like that, but you had Lainey, who obviously is bouncing around all over the country. She's trying to, you know, stay nimble and do all of this. And, you know, she went to the first birthday party for her child and everything. But there is a time that Lainey decides that she's going to get married again. And Lainey Greenberger marries Larry Greenberger. And Larry Greenberger, was probably one of the biggest drug dealers in the United States at one point. He would smuggle drugs from Colombia up into Florida, and he would use a little island called Norman's Key. I don't know if anybody's heard of Norman's, but you might have heard of it a couple of years ago, because that's where the original Fyre Festival was supposed to be held. It is Pablo Escobar's island. And when they mentioned it was Pablo Escobar's island, then they got kicked off the island. But this is where he would hang out. That's where he ran his drugs through. This guy was the biggest of the big deals in America. When Laney found him, he was kind of living off the interest of all of this money and things like that. On September 13th, 1988, he's only 40 years old at that time, even though he's had a really, really long and hard life, it seems. But he's got Laney, and he's also adopted Dax, and they're living back in his hometown. And at 7 minutes after midnight, Laney said she'd been awakened by a single gunshot, had rushed to her husband, and discovered the worst. And then when police arrived, they found Larry on the front porch of his house. He was slumped in his favorite chair, had a .44 caliber Magnum in his hand and a bullet hole in his head. His bathroom was soaked in blood, but his eyes were still wide open. The police said, okay. So then in the autopsy, they found that he had had a lot of alcohol that night. He had smoked some pot, snorted some cocaine, but it was how he died. The coroner said that the bullet entered just below the left eye, passing at a downward angle out of the back of his head, through the chair and into the wall of the house. And apparently the powder burn around the bullet wound was too wide for a point-blank shooting. So I guess it had to be fired from a distance greater than the length of his own arm. And he had been shot from the left side, even though the pistol was found in his right hand. And they said, well, you know, if he did that, the .44 Magnum would have kicked the gun right out of his hand. So it was a murder rigged to look like a suicide. The only people in the house that night were Larry, who was dead. Then Laney, and then Dax, who was six. And then a 21-year-old Pennsylvania guy named Terry Squillante, who Laney had met at a real estate licensing school in Orlando. So I'm guessing that she was probably sleeping with him too.
Oh, yeah. She's like, here, let me give you some money to shoot my husband. He's getting on my nerves. He's like, okay.
Because right after the police and everything, Laney and this Squillante guy, they went to Miami. She came back for the funeral, but then she was bouncing around. She was going to Miami, Denver, Orlando. And then, you know, this detective in the sheriff's office was trying to learn about her and, you know, found out about the Cotton Club murders. And that's kind of, I guess they hadn't known about it, maybe, that she was part of it. Now I'll go back in time. So we had that meeting room of Laney and Belichasis where I'm wondering if he's giving permission, right?
Yes.
And so Tim Whitehead, who is one of the couriers other than Rogers, he had said during Laney's trial that he had been present at Belichasis' house on May 9th or 10th, which would have been, I think, the week after that Robert Evans and her were there. And then this Mensur guy was talking on the phone, and Mensur hung up the phone, I guess, while he was in Miami. Again, this doesn't really make 100% sense, because I thought Mensur was one of the bodyguards for Laney. And then he's in Miami with Belichasis. But anyway.
How it worked was these bodyguard people, these enforcers, were contract hitmen on the side. They would do anything for money. These were people that were either down on their luck or just kind of needed a leg up in life. And Laney and in the Colombian drug lords collected people like that so they could use them. You know, you get somebody that'll do anything for you. It's like the perfect kind of like handyman.
So you had this Whitehead guy say that Mensur hung up the phone all excited, and it was like, bingo. Mensur had learned that Radin had been in daily contact with Rogers, who was hiding out in St. Thomas. The police never corroborated that. And then that's how they said, oh, well, Radin's not her friend. He's a party to this ripoff of all the coke and the money. And then so then Bella Chassis ordered Mensur and Marty to go to Los Angeles to straighten things out with Raiden. Now, this was like testimony from the Whitehead guy, and it really kind of helped Lainey. And he even said, I wanted to help Lainey. I knew she was getting a very raw deal. I mean, Lainey's guilty of a lot of things that she's paying the price for now. But as far as this, no. There's too many people who ripped off Lainey in the past, and she didn't take any action. She wrote it off. So that, I think, alone, just that little bit of testimony, definitely knocked a lot of time off of Lainey's sentence. Do I think that Lainey was involved in this? Hell yeah.
Well, yeah, because Larry Flint's brother-in-law also appears in the court records. His name's Billy Ryder. He told the Los Angeles detectives that he heard Mensur and Marty bragging about the murder at one of Larry Flint's poker parties, and that he agreed to wear a wire and act as an informant so he could collect this information, you know, basically for the police, and he did. And there's Lainey Greenberger telling basically Evans that she's going to pay for the contract killing and that Mensur and Marty are going to be the physical trigger pullers. So all of that stuff's in the court papers.
I mean,
so how could she not be a part of it?
Exactly. Now, what she said is that, well, in her testimony, she says, Mr. Raiden, she called everybody when she got up on the stand to testify in her own defense. And she referred to everybody as Mr. Raiden, Mr. Evans, kind of like that, Mr. Mensur. And she said, Mr. Raiden and I were talking about the movie. He was in a boisterous, belligerent mood. He was telling me I ought to get on his side, that he was going to take over the company, not Mr. Evans. And that apparently, according to her, he was so rambunctious that he knocked over the champagne bucket filled with ice. And I was in the process of leaning over to pick it up, and all of a sudden the limo turned up a side street very quickly. Suddenly, the two back doors open, and Mr. Mensur told me to get out and get into the other car. And the lawyer said, why did you listen? I didn't know what else to do.
What a bullshit story.
I know. And then, later, I guess Lainey talked with one of her hired hands and said, quote, they grabbed the fat pig. They were taking him to the desert. So that's what Lainey told this guy that at least he testified to. And then when she left this guy, Carl Pizak, she said, quote, you haven't seen me all night. So that's all going on, right? They were going to go to dinner. What time did they go to dinner? 8 o'clock or something like that?
Yeah.
And by 10:30 p.m., she's at a bar to see her old pal. And they have a couple of drinks. And then they walked over to this guy's house around the corner where Lainey decided to make a half a dozen phone calls. And at 3:21 a.m. New York time, she calls Robert Evans in Manhattan.
See what she did there? She goes to someone else's house to make the calls. So the calls don't come out of any residence linked to her. It's smart.
It is. And it's 3:21, and she calls Robert Evans and talks to him for almost 15 minutes. And she had also called him before her date with Raiden. Now, she said, at this point, I was talking to him at least once a day. And I told him that we had an argument in the limo and that I had been put out of the car. And it was this last phone call that convinced prosecutors that Robert Evans knew more than what he said he did.
He had to, because the two contract killers went on to talk about how when they kidnapped Roy Raiden and took him out to the Grumman Desert, they held him for hours. They didn't kill him right away. So you have to think, what were they interrogating him about? What were they asking him? Was that information being relayed back to Lainey? Why was she making so many phone calls? And then she calls Evans. So, you know, what information were they getting? All of that's interesting.
It's especially interesting because they don't have really cell phones at this time or anything, and they wouldn't have had, you know, towers in the desert anyway. So the prosecutor said, they asked Lainey, what did you think Mensur and Marty were going to do with Raiden? Quote, I thought Mensur was just going to talk to him. And apparently she said this really softly about where Tally was and that she didn't have a clue that Raiden was dead until Mensur phoned her to come meet him at 5 a.m. And she said she got really upset, but she didn't call the police because I was involved in drug dealing. But the next day, she put aside her shock and she boarded a private jet to Miami with all of the murderers.
Oh, of course she did. Of course. You know, she knew what was up. Evans knew what was up because the whole time this is going on, Evans is getting super paranoid. He calls up basically the Dumani brothers and they were mobbed up, you know, over the casinos and stuff in Las Vegas. So he starts asking them for protection. Why do you need protection? It's because you know that Roy Raiden's about to get his block knocked off.
And so, and then 2 days after Roy's murder, that's when the first birthday party went off for Dax. And there was a bunch of children. Mensa was there. Marty was there. Belichasis was there. And that somehow she managed to give him a payment of 200 grand to pay for the stolen coke. I don't know where she got it from. But that's at that party, well, right after the party. That's when Belichasis apparently first learned of Raiden's death. And that he went crazy and he was upset and then he was screaming and that the last thing he needed was a murder. Because it wasn't that long after this that Belichasis gets arrested and then convicted and sentenced to, I think, 20 years in jail. I looked and I cannot find him, but I'm not looking in the right place. I mean, it's an easy name, but Google keeps wanting me to call it something else. I'm assuming that he is out of jail if he is still alive. So I would, you know, I'd be interested to know anyway. So yeah. It's really interesting to me that this source says that he was upset, but we had this meeting 4 or 5 days earlier. Maybe he thought they were just going to have a talk with him. Maybe he didn't actually order, you know, the death. Maybe he just wanted him questioned about whether or not he knew where Rogers was.
I tend to think the higher up on the tier coat guy knows more than Evans. So if Evans knew about all of this, then the Belichaz guy knew about it too. I think they're all just what they think, they're very good liars. I think they're very bad liars. But all of this for a movie that they spent $60 million to make, right? It only raked in $25 million. No, that's terrible.
It is. It was a big, big flop. There was a question that a lawyer asked Laney during the trial and says, are you aware of any fact that would link Mr. Evans to Mr. Raiden's death? And then she said, no, I am not. But the problem is that Evans had told the police only a week earlier that he had first learned of Raiden's murder a month after it happened, which I guess would have been about the time that his body was found. But Laney testified that she and Mensah met with Evans in New York just 3 days after the murder. So I'm trying to get a timeline here. Because we have her a day after the murder flying to Miami. We have 2 days after the murder, she's at her son's birthday party. So then 3 days later, I guess they went from Miami to New York. And so she's pretty busy. And this is when she says that she told him that Raiden was dead. Because I thought he should know, she explained. And that he got very, very upset, almost panic-stricken. He kept saying, why, I don't understand. And Evan said that after that, he had only heard from Laney one time. And that after that conversation, he knew that she wasn't going to be the next Mrs. Evans. However, Evans was lying about that, too. There was two calls made from Laney's room on May 17th. So she really did 3 days later. I mean, so she went, murders a guy, flies to Miami, next day, birthday party, next day, flies to New York. And that Evans came to her room to see her. And Laney says that Evans made calls after she told him that Raiden was dead. So he made calls to his attorney to see what he, you know, have to do. You don't have to report a murder. It's not actually a crime. But because of nobody reporting this and Robert Evans not saying what he knew at the time, so then you have this prosecution where you don't even have an arrest for 5 more years and then another 3 years after that before you have a trial. And the other thing was that Evans had always said, oh, I didn't know that she was a drug dealer. But then when she gets him in court, she said that she had told Evans really early on in the relationship that she was a drug dealer and that he didn't care.
He hung out with her because she was a drug dealer.
You know, and I don't know if Evans had anything to do with the murder, but he certainly knew a lot about it. And it wouldn't, you know, surprise me if he knew in advance that that's what they were planning to do. Now, that would be a crime if he knew ahead of time that they were going to murder somebody and he didn't say anything. It also seems to me, you know, that, yeah, you don't have to report a murder. However, if Laney comes to him And we don't know if she said, oh, I know who killed him. But if she had said, oh, I know who killed him, and he doesn't say anything, then I think it makes it, you know, a co-conspirator after the fact, doesn't it?
Well, yeah.
You know,
the only reason
that
Evans
didn't
get wrapped up in this in a nice bow was, A, they couldn't put it in a product. They couldn't prove the fact that he knew it, even premeditated or not. And second, he was on another alleged payroll to where he was working on something else in the background. So technically, they wouldn't have touched him, because, you know, when FBI and other branches are working with people, they don't mess them up. It doesn't matter really what happens along the way. You know, they overlook it. Just look at Whitney Burglar, that guy from The Lady of the Dunes. He was doing all kind of stuff because he was mobbed up. The FBI had to look another way because they granted him immunity because he was helping them. Evans is like 6 degrees adjacent, if not directly in something like that, in my opinion. When you read the other stories about him, everything kind of points to that.
So after they found Roy's body, I mean, in this, I can't even imagine to have shot 13 times, the dynamite.
When they found pieces of his body.
Yes. They call it desiccated. I'm not even sure how they actually found any pieces, especially a month later in a desert. But Frank Rubino, the lawyer for Laney, the one who later represented Manuel Noriega and stuff, he kept the LA police from interviewing at all. Just essentially, she's traveling around, low profile, traveling with Mensur, who, you know, she's having sex with at that point. And they hold up in Mexico for a month. Then they went to Palm Springs. Then they went to Maui. Then they went to Vegas. Then she broke up with Mensur, goes to Miami, and 6 months after Raiden's murder, she meets Larry Greenberger, the guy that I talked about earlier. It was a blind date arranged by their mutual attorney, Frank Rubino. And they got married September 84, and then he was dead, you know, 3.5 years later, essentially. Murdered.
These men with Laney have expiration dates.
They do. And this guy, Larry, like I said, he was a big deal. And he was probably the second in command in the entire United States. And he had avoided doing any kind of hard time. And he had been from 1977 until probably around the time of Laney, he had been that big. And he had tens of millions of dollars that he was living on. Maybe as much as $100 million. Who really, really knows? He was the highest level of the Medellin drug cartel. But it was also this good old boy from Florida. And, you know, it's just kind of a little bit crazy. Laney says that when she met Larry, they retired from the drug trade. But that Whitehead guy says that Laney always sold him coke whenever he wanted, kilos at a time. So... and that Greenberger was still transporting, you know, arms and Uzis again through Norman's Cay in the Bahamas. And it's just kind of, you know, that they would do drugs and things like this. But she's kind of here. And then she decides, hey, I'm kind of bored. I'm going to do this plastic surgery thing. And what she would do is she would arrange for patients to fly to Mexico City to get plastic surgery and things like that. But what happens is, there are this cases kind of going on in the background, and they're called the Sons of Later trials. Later was the guy who was in charge of the Medellin drug cartel in America. And there's 50 cases coming from his conviction. So Larry, you know, He wants to disappear, and he's into this whole cosmetic procedure thing. He's trying to change his face. He's not having very good luck. It doesn't really look that good. He's on a lot of drugs. Laney wants him to stop, you know, using Frank as the lawyer. And I just, like you said earlier, you know, these people went to prison to escape Laney. I kind of feel this is where he was at this point. And on July 25th, 1986, Laney and Greenberger went to their lawyer's office, accompanied again by Bill Mensur and Markle, and that they said that they were going to kill him if he didn't sign over half the boat, and they're going to kill his wife. So 10 minutes later, gives him the boat, gives him the gold Rolex on his wrist, gives him the keys to his new Ferrari. And then 2 years later, Larry's dead. So this is what gets Laney in trouble. Because first of all, the whole family thinks that, she killed him. All the Greenbergers think that same thing. And the detective said that, and even Tim Whitehead said that Lainey and Larry had arguments about business and money, quote, and that Larry had a nasty, coke habit and drink, and I understand he was pretty freaked out about being indicted, but if Larry had committed suicide, it would have been cut and dried. He knew guns, he knew how to kill.
Yeah, I mean, his autopsy points to the fact that he didn't kill himself. That
for sure.
That was a fix-up job. He probably gave somebody some money to look the other way.
Probably, you know?
Yeah, I mean, why else would he be there? Why would she bring someone like that in?
And then take off with him and do this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So when I read about the thing before, when I read about his death, and I said, you know, they were trying to pursue things and they were having a lot of trouble. And then the people in Florida found out about the Cotton Club murders. And the people in L.A., found out about this. So in Los Angeles, in between 1983 and 1988, the LA District Attorney's Office was working on this. This was not something that they had just shunted to the side. And they had really spent a lot of the summer of 1988 really trying to get a case. What can we do in this raid and killing? So then they learn about Greenberger's death, Larry's death. And they get worried because they know that Lainey will bounce and that Lainey might finally just leave the country. Remember, she did that before. She went to Mexico and things like that. And they think that she will leave the country. So in a little subterfuge, the Florida police in Orlando got Lainey into the police station on October 2nd, 1988. And they promised her in writing that she would only be questioned, not arrested, for her husband's death. So they were pretty sneaky about this. So when she gets there, though, they arrested her for the murder of Roy Radin.
Nice.
Yes. But the thing is, and the Florida state attorney was perfectly willing to go along with this because he said that, look, yeah, when you're dead, you don't normally hold on to anything. But after a couple of years, he was really pessimistic about ever kind of resolving the case. He knew that there was a motive, you know, because there was a bunch of money missing. The estate was actually valued at $3.2 million, but apparently, you know, he had at least 20. Some people said 100. And then the questions were, okay, Lainey's been in jail, you know, and doing this trial for almost 3 years, using some of the best attorneys. How is she paying for it? You know, and she was also supporting that Terry guy, the 21-year-old, while she's in jail. And his family, because they were raising her son in Pennsylvania.
Are you that, or you mostly probably hush money for knocking up her husband.
So, okay, there's all that. And then on the day that Larry died, Lainey, Larry, and Terry, quite the combo, had been target shooting in the backyard. So this was brilliant on the part of Lainey and Terry, or probably Lainey, because when the police powder tested Lainey and Terry, the results were meaningless because everybody was shooting handguns all day long.
That's it's horrible, but it's also brilliant.
It is totally brilliant. And so I know that it wasn't the 21-year-old real estate agent who thought of that. It was Lainey. And just, you know what I'll do? Is we'll just shoot guns all day. And it is brilliant because, and so every person in the house, all you got to do is stick to your story because they can't prove that you were holding that gun. And if you were, if they find a fingerprint, great. Yeah, we were shooting that one too.
Oh yeah. Straight out of the book of arms dealers. She knew that.
You know, it's crazy. And then in 1991, I think it was Greenberger's parents got a call, and it was from Mensur, and he was in jail in Los Angeles. And he was calling the Greenbergers because he wanted the number to this Florida state attorney. And he wanted to talk to him about the death of Larry. And so this guy said, you know, that this Greenberger said, hey, I'm Larry's dad, and I'd like to know what you have to say. And then Mensur said that Lainey threw Mensur under the bus, and that, quote, she found God, and God told her to eat, to tell all these stories, and she's up there lying through her teeth. And that Mensur told Larry's dad that he had had a call from Lainey asking him to kill Larry. And, quote, I told her no because I liked Larry. And at Larry's funeral, Mensur claimed that Lainey sidled up to Mensur and whispered, quote, I did it myself and Terry helped me. Well, I think that that was probably pretty obvious. And I don't think Mensur's lying about that at all.
Oh, no. That sounds pretty straight up.
It does. And I think that he wanted to throw Lainey under the bus. I don't even think that he actually wanted to save himself for any kind of sentence at all. He just wanted to, and maybe he did a little bit because, I mean, but I really think he wanted to get Lainey back because he knew that Lainey was going to get a really short sentence and that he was going to get a death.
I don't think that guy cared because he was already bragging about multiple other people that he had killed. You know, he's at Larry Flint's apartment or house or whatever that place was bragging. And then, you know, someone in Larry Flint's family overheard that. And that's how this whole thing, it came together to begin with. But when you have braggers, you think your plan will fall apart.
Now, as of the end of the trial, all four defendants were found guilty on charges of murder and kidnapping for financial gain. So you had Marty and Mensur were found guilty of first degree murder, sentenced to death, but I don't think either one of them have ever actually been given the death. And then Robert Lowe and Lainey were found guilty of second degree murder, and they got a 16-year to life sentence. I have not seen that Lainey is out yet, but 1991 to 2020. I mean, she should be out, probably. I need to look at that.
Yeah, if she's not out, it would definitely be coming up at least.
Yeah. I mean, they might have said, okay, you don't get to come out for a while. And then Rogers, he went to jail, but for a totally different thing. He got sentenced to 15 years in jail for molesting his girlfriend's children. And then his wife, the one that, you know, had been in Vegas and stuff, Betty Rogers, apparently she is an extremely wealthy woman. And I wonder how, maybe she got a little boost with the $200,000 or $300,000 in cash and all the kilos of coke. And she's probably just living off of that. And as of the end of the trial, you know, Terry was still raising, Lainey's son all the time. And then Robert Evans, of course, you know, nothing happened to him. And I think
how he went out is weird, though, because did you read that about the 1998, how he was at Wes Craven's dinner party? And he was given a toast when he suffered a 3 strokes, a quick succession at a medical ordeal. He was raced to Cedar Sinai. And then at the same time that they're reviving him and working on him, Frank Sinatra is dying of a heart attack in the room next door. And he said he remembers thinking like, oh, man, you know, it's Frank. But, I mean, Frank was kind of mobbed up, too. So,
yeah,
these guys kind of all knew each other. And he just talked about how he watched Frank Sinatra's body covered with a sheet being wheeled past his room. And he said, you know, me and Summer Redstone were sitting in there and we thought, you know, hey, I need to get better.
There was when I talk about Betty Rogers being rich, you know, originally there was supposed to be, you know, like 200,000. The final total, I guess, that somebody had come up with that Rogers had stolen from the safe was a grand total of about $1 million worth of coke and cash. So, I mean, that would have given Betty quite the, you know, windfall or whatever to keep living. I do want to see Lainey Greenberger paroled. I'm just going to see if it comes up with anything. Actually, I guess that original sentence was 16 to life, but actually it's an automatic sentence of life in prison without parole. So.
Oh, so she's in for the long haul.
Yeah, she's in for the long haul. I'm looking at it from 1992, and it says Karen Delane, Lainey Greenberger, convicted last July. Oh, I guess the kidnapping count also made it. It's an automatic sentence of life in prison without parole. So, yeah, she's probably still in there. Marty sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Yeah. So she's in there, and.
And the men of Florida were safe again.
Yes. Yes. I think so. So that's, I guess she's still in there. It would be interesting to find out what happened to, her son, and if her son took, you know, because the one guy adopted him. So I'm assuming that Dax took the name Dax Greenberger. But I can't find it at all. I need to probably look that up too.
I hope she's writing a book in prison, because short of it being horrible that she's a murderess, allegedly, she's fascinating, though. She is a mastermind of several different circuits and things going on, and somebody like her should write a book.
It looks like that there was a case while she was in jail, before she was sentenced, to write about it, because they say that she's 41, and I think she was 43 when she was sentenced, but apparently she's got a life estate interest in that home of Larry Greenberger. And Mrs. Greenberger wasn't willing to tell everybody where her son was. Interesting. It's just, there's an appellate thing that went on, I guess, during the, oh, they were denying her bail. And then I guess it went up and it said denial of bail cannot be justified in this case because there's no finding.
If they had gave her bail, she would have been out of the country.
I know. So that's kind of what it was about, was that. Oh, all right. Well, we are finally finished. I think it's a fascinating case in the sense that we went from Adnan and Epstein and all of that kind of stuff, and we went through the entire cocaine world. We brought in the Fyre Festival, really, because that is exactly what they were talking about and what they were hyping up when they originally did Fyre Festival. That's why they kept saying Pablo Escobar's Island. This is a case that actually, you know, somebody was there all the time, and, you know, they were involved in all of this, and Lainey was married to that guy and got involved in the movie business and murdered somebody, and, you know, just, it's got everything.
It was a very, very interesting case.
It was. Well, Jen, I hope that you have a great weekend. I hope that everybody out there stays safe, and I know a lot of places are opening up, and, you know, you do you. You know, but I'm still here in California and still inside, and I really,
and you still
really
need groceries.
I still need groceries. I'm actually going to have to go out to get them, which is not my favorite thing to do, because everybody knows, and you know, Jen, that I get sick, frequently, and I'm afraid.
Yes, and
sometimes.
You guys, that's why I don't want him to go outside, because he's so susceptible. So mask and gloves.
Yes, mask and gloves. But the thing is that I don't want to have to go through all of this again. I don't want in 3 weeks and all, you know, some bunch of cases spiking and everybody says, oh, we got to get locked down again. And then everybody's just like, but we've already done it for so long. We could already be out. So I worry.
And I would
that.
Encourage those people to read about 1917, 1918.
Yes, exactly. Anyway, I hope everybody has a great weekend. Jen, I hope you have a great weekend. And
thank you. Mwah. Always an honor. And everyone have a good weekend.
Talk to you later.
Bye.